Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Hey, everybody. Hey, monkeys. Welcome. Today, should I start over? Should I edit this? Why bother? Warts and all, baby. That's what podcasting is. Today, we're talking to writer Seth M. Sherwood, who is one of the writers for the horror film opening this weekend, Hellfest. We dig into it. We talk about Hellfest. We talk about the horror genre. We talk about Star Wars, perhaps a little bit too much. It is a great conversation, and you will love it. And I'm going to keep this quick because, one, you don't care about these intros. And, two, I had to turn the air conditioning off so it didn't make a whole lot of noise. And it's getting warm. So, Seth Sherwood, Hellfest, let's do it. Welcome back in the monkey cage, my friend.
Welcome back. That's right. I've been here before.
Yeah, this is Seth M. Sherwood Returns.
Yeah, it is. I'm sorry. I realized there was a cough button right here. I was already distracted.
If you want to play with it,
no,
you
can. No, that's okay. If I cough, I'll do it.
It actually makes you cough. That's the joke. I would advise anybody who's checking out this episode based upon the fact that Hellfest is coming out in theaters this Friday, etc., and you might have some interest in what Mr. Sherwood has done in the past, you can hear his entire early history in episode number one with Seth and Snark Monkey if you search back in the archives there. So we're not going to go over every particular detail of your adolescence and your,
we've done that. We've had that block of therapy.
Occupational embarrassments or any of those other things. Speaking of embarrassments, no, that's a terrible segue.
It's what I base my life around, so really it's okay.
When we did talk, it was prior to the release of Leatherface.
Yes.
Which was the reason we kind of got together, and it gave us an excuse to get back together and hang out again. We did, spoiler alert, on episode one, we did used to work together at the same company, doing completely different stuff.
Different.
Leatherface as an experience, because that was, we talked about this in that first episode, talk about in the genre, if you can say Leatherface is a beloved character, I don't know.
Sure.
But a revered, perhaps.
Revered is a good
horror
term.
Character. Which, of course, much like other people rebooting or revamping or redoing or anything, I just talked to Paul Feig a couple of weeks ago, who was accused of killing people's childhoods with the Ghostbusters reboot.
Yes.
You got your share of crap from people because that was your baby. That was your...
there was a lot of things. The directors did a great job. The producers did a great job in letting me do whatever I wanted. I made some choices. The problems with it kind of happened on the distributor end. Mm-hmm. They didn't know. They had released another horror movie that was sort of a reboot, remake sort of thing that did not do so well. So they were afraid to spend money on it. So they shelved it for a while. And then when they decided to put it out, because enough people were making noise that they weren't confident about what was there and they wanted to cut things and they wanted to change things around. So ultimately, if you have the DVD, like, all the scenes that I wish were in the movie are on there as deleted scenes.
Really?
And they waited so long to do it that the production company lost the license to it. So it'll probably be like another reboot which would be the third one for the,
coming from a completely different source.
Yeah. I've heard talk about a TV show. I mean, it's okay. I mean, I get people send me hate mail because they love the character. and ultimately I don't care. I mean, I don't I should probably take death threats more seriously, but I don't.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess. I mean, it's weird to say that in the horror genre, you know, somebody wants to threaten to kind of flay the skin or you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you talk to Paul Feig, I mean, he got it at a very wide level. And then we're seeing a lot with the last couple Star Wars movies, too. And
oh, sure.
You know, I was a member of fandom, both just genre, sci-fi, comic book, horror, you know, all the fandoms. I was, you know, into that for a long, long time. And I've just, you know, slowly started to really sort of dislike, there's a level of fandom that's just a little extra that...
Well, here we're going to be get off my lawn, old guys yelling.
Yeah, no.
But it's the internet gives everyone a platform to be at their loudest, most despicable selves.
Yes.
And with some degree of, you know, cowardice anonymity.
No, I read this great...
See, President Trump? I can't say it either. Anonymity.
I read this interview with Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails, and he said, like, when Twitter and social media first started to grow, at first he thought, like, this is great. Like, an artist can talk directly to their fans. And after about a year, he was like, this is a terrible idea. And, you know, he was like, when I was a kid and I liked, you know, Bowie and Pink Floyd or whatever, it's like, all I knew of them was what, you know, what little snippets I can read in Rolling Stone magazine or whatever. And it's not that those people need to be on a pedestal or need to be thought of as special or they need their fragile egos protected. But in terms of being creative, you do have to be in sort of a vacuum a little bit. It's this strange curse that I think is kind of just across all mediums of art and creativity, is that you really have to be in and of yourself to be able to be creative. But the only gauge of success you have is how it's received by the masses.
Right, right.
And it's like you are like... You have
and
to,
you want that. I mean,
you,
look,
you do.
You're doing is a mass consumption kind of art, which, you know, one measure of that it works is that people see it. People like it. People go back. It becomes part of the culture.
Right.
I mean, that, you know, that is the culmination of what you are aspiring to do.
Right.
Yeah.
And if people don't like it, it used to be, then, you know, it would just quietly go away. But now they will reach out to you because they can, and they will let you know, you know, what's wrong with your movie, your life, your face, your ideas, everything, you know.
Which is funny because even back in the day when you used to be able to do something bad and let it just go away, it's still out there. Like, for instance, George right. Lucas never thought the Star Wars Christmas special would ever see the light of day again.
He tried to...
It's buried in some vault in Montana right now, but didn't realize that people did record it on VHS.
Do you know about the E.T. Atari 2600 video game?
Like, they literally
dug it up in Mexico.
They literally buried it. So everything comes back.
Yes.
But you're talking about, I can think of three genres in particular in terms of kind of, you know, mass appeal entertainment. Horror, sci-fi, fantasy are the ones that, for some reason, the fandom reaches the highest level.
Yes.
I mean, do you understand why people get... I mean, you look at things like Comic-Con, and you look at the way people embrace those characters. I mean, they certainly, in many cases, they embody maybe a personification of what you would like to be or aspects of your personality that you are allowed to let out. I mean, we could analyze, just talk in general about cosplay, you know, for hours about what that means to certain people.
Yeah.
But horror in particular is very interesting because it usually is the just darkest side of human nature, the most, you know, evil, depraved aspect of what people do.
And
which many people find fascinating, and it's really passionate. And those three in particular.
Yes.
And so you've got an arena where, you know, because as a fan, you know how passionate you get about it.
Yeah.
How, you know, I can't imagine what your house looks like around Halloween.
I mean, around Halloween, it's, I mean, I'm pretty good. My partner, Emily, you know, luckily, my tastes are very broad, so like my house doesn't look like a Halloween store all year round. My office does, but you know the rest of the house is very tasteful. But yeah, on around Halloween, there's a couple, like, you know, 12-foot inflatable ghosts that my neighbors hate that show up in the front yard. I actually just worked on a project with this guy named Rich Carell, who is He's a child actor. He was like the Beavs' best friend on Leave It to Beaver, and then he went into production.
Oh, wow.
He's directed more. He's directed like 700 episodes of sitcom TV. He does like Fuller House. He co-created Hannah Montana. Anyway, he's one of these dudes. He's just, I just drove by his house on the way here over on Rimpo, who has like the crazy stuff. He's got like three semis.
I know that house.
Worth of material.
Yes.
That come from a warehouse in Ohio. And, you know, on Halloween night, there's 1,000 people around the block.
Right, right.
That's my goal. I don't remember what the question was, but I'm just going to say that's my life goal.
Well, do you understand? I mean, because you started as a fan.
As a fan.
And now you're in a world where you are hearing from fans. Do you understand what draws people to, especially in the horror genre, what is it? Is it that thing about, you know, just being able to kind of embrace these dark things in a somewhat safe manner?
Yeah, I think, I mean, generally speaking, for genre on the whole, I do think, you know, when I was a kid, you know, it was my aunt and her weird friends who, you know, took me in. They were the ones that went to the Doctor Who conventions and liked their comic books. And, you know, and that was sort of where my introduction to a lot of that stuff came in. And I think it's kind of what you're just saying about social media, is that with the internet, is that these, you know, this used to be like outsider culture. Like comic book nerds were like the people who were bullied. And since pop culture has sort of embraced genre and it's become the biggest thing ever,
mm-hmm.
You know, those people who were kind of weird and marginalized are strangely now the mainstream ones. And I think that this is what causes that, you know, their voices get louder and more intense, because, you know, it's like when your favorite band in college, you know, becomes a top 40 hit and you have to tell everyone how you like them before they sold out.
Yeah, that's right. And be very angry.
Absolutely.
In a way that you have to share this with the world. It's kind of that dichotomy. In music, it happens a lot, because you are constantly telling somebody, you got to hear this band, man. Nobody knows about them. And then they get hit mainstream success. It's like, ah, man, screw that. No, they're terrible now. It's like you want to share it with people, but you don't want it to be popular, because you still want it to be a thing that you discovered. It's ridiculous.
And you know, this, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, like fantasy, like you know, Game of Thrones is like one of the biggest shows there is.
It just won tons of Emmys. I mean, you couldn't get more mainstream and more, you know, establishment than that.
Yeah. So I think what you have is that we look at fandom as a whole, but it's really sort of fractured. I mean, there's still, you know, core fans are the same people that have always been there. There's these people who come in from the mainstream side that, like, you know, tend to want to take ownership of it, and that makes the original fans like mad. And then you have this growing contingent of bro fans who are, you know, it's weird. It's like the people who were like bro bullies when I was a kid, like now they like you know, now they like these things too, and then they have to be very angry about it. Like, I have very mixed feelings about the last Star Wars movie myself.
Me too.
And I could say, like, my problems with it were structural, my problems with it were this, and here's what I think they should have done, is my, you know, my, because my opinion is very important. But I'm not like, but what I'm not doing is like driving people off social media with my nasty comment. Like,
right. You didn't internalize it in a way that has made you angry about it. Like, it's affected your life.
Yes.
To where I think there is a point where people do get, like,
for sure,
like viscerally and also physically upset. Like, if they could, they would punch Rian Johnson in the face.
I mean, let it go. I think what happens is that, and whether it's mainstream or whether it's not, is that a lot of, you know, people need things. People need something in their life that tells them they're not insignificant. You know, for some people find religion, some people find music. Everybody finds their thing. Sometimes it's, you know, just something they do within their own life. For people who are deep, deep into fandom, that thing sort of becomes their life. I mean, I love Star Wars. I was raised on Star Wars. I would reach across this table and punch you in the face if somebody said I could write a Star Wars movie. But I don't decorate my house with, I mean, well, I do have like half a dozen lightsabers in my office.
Right.
But like in my living room, where people come in and sit down, and, you know, from all walks of life, whenever, you know, the one time a year I have company, I don't have a giant Darth Vader standing in the corner. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No.
But there becomes a level of fandom where people like, okay, this is my main thing in life. This is what like gives me passion and gives me joy. And that's great. If it gives you joy and it's not hurting anybody, like, it's fine. If you want Darth Vader in your living room and that makes you happy and your friends come over to make them happy, that's all cool. It's all great. I'm not talking down about that. But some people who love their thing that much, when something comes along, like, say, a Star Wars movie by Rian Johnson, that shows them that, like, no, you actually don't own this thing.
Yeah.
And we're going to do something with it that you don't potentially like.
And it may not satisfy exactly
There's a melt. Some people will have a meltdown. Not all, but some people will have a meltdown over that because they've, in their head, you know, taken ownership of this thing that they love so much because it means so much to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could argue all day if we could talk about Star Wars the entire time I'm here if we want to. I mean, Rian Johnson, on the one hand, I don't think he owes anybody anything. And, you know, as a creative, I totally understand that, like, you don't go into a movie trying to, like, play it safe and give everybody what they want. But at the same time, when you know you have the biggest fandom in the universe, like, just dying to see what you want to do, you should give them a little bit of a cookie. This is a conversation I've had with Galen Hurd, who is producer on Hellfest.
Oh,
who
yeah.
Run, you know, is the overseer of the Walking Dead. And, you know, whenever I've talked to her about that show, which I watch in chunks and go away from chunks and come back and catch up.
Yeah.
And I told her the reason I do that is because I'm like, you guys don't like to give the audience a cookie. I personally feel like if you're going to drag somebody through the mud and like make them feel terrible and give them anxiety, you should give them a cookie at the end of it so they feel better about their day. And Walking Dead holds their cookies for a very long time until they give them out.
Yeah, I was in a binge mode with Walking Dead because I had started it and then left it behind. And so I think I jumped in around like season 3 and I was catching up 3 through 5.
Yeah.
So I was jamming. So it was like a couple of episodes every day. And
you had no idea why you were so depressed.
Oh, no. I immediately recognized I felt like shit because there had been no, like you say, there is no.
Release.
I'll make a comparison. A lot of people talk about The Wire as maybe one of the best shows ever.
Sure.
And, but if you watch it now, it doesn't kind of move in the same way that contemporary television does, especially some of the bingeable TV. So I watched it as a binge when it had originally been a weekly. And just not a lot happens.
Yeah.
But it builds kind of this infrastructure that very kind of slowly, it's character-driven for sure, but what you really are hoping for them to have a victory is when they get just a fucking approval just to get a wire. I mean, that's it. It's like they finally get the warrant or whatever passed, and it takes like 5 episodes. And what? I remember watching that and going, woo! And that was my cookie. That was the biggest, tastiest cookie of all time.
Well, that's because they would structure an entire season like a movie. Like when you watch a movie, it's despair until you get to the third act, which in a movie is the last, like, you know, 30 minutes.
Right.
And when you're only sitting there for an hour and a half or 2 hours, that's like a good build up and release. You stretch that out to 12 hours. I mean, really, all the payoff comes in The Wire within the last two, three episodes
of each season.
But that's why it also hits you so hard.
It does. It's very impactful that way. So they reserve their cookies too. But I get your point about The Walking Dead.
Also, they break their season in half. Yeah. So they'll give you half a season and then make you wait 4 months. So then you're waiting like almost a year for a cookie.
Yeah.
And I like cookies.
I love cookies. And then it turns out, you know, you get to the cookie and then it's like oatmeal raisin. It's like, fuck you.
Right.
No, like, I actually like oatmeal raisin, but I know people hate it. I do. Actually, it's my favorite cookie.
That is upsetting.
What? Oatmeal raisin. You know what? I will stand by oatmeal raisin anytime.
If I know it's oatmeal raisin, I won't eat it. For me, it's the betrayal where you think you're getting a chocolate chip cookie and then you realize you're eating a raisin and you're like,
you got to adjust your cookie attitude, man. If you're going in going, I hope this is oatmeal raisin, and then it turns out to be some sort of oatmeal chocolate chip concoction. You're like, oh, well, that's a surprise. I was expecting a tasty, somewhat healthy feeling oatmeal raisin.
Mm. I had a chocolate chip cookie that was a peanut butter cookie at the same time, and that was a joyous treat.
Yeah,
that
gave you a little
surprise.
let's talk about
Cookie. This is Snark Cookie.
Yeah,
the podcast.
How many? Oh, we could go there. how many cookies are in Hellfest? Hellfest looks actually like a real treat. The spooky amusement park kind of idea, or a spooky haunted house kind of idea, is certainly not anything. I mean, Scooby Doo for crying out loud!
Right. there's a few greats. There's Funhouse by Toby Hooper, right. Which is one of my favorites. There's a couple others that have come out in the last couple of years that are like touch on similar themes. I mean, go to any website saying anything about Hellfest and there'll be a horror bro saying, what about this movie?
Yeah.
And he stole it. The thing is this is like I have not gone anywhere to talk about this movie yet where someone didn't say like, oh my God, I thought the same thing last time I was in one of these haunted houses. It's not even my original idea. There was a script before me that I basically started over with the concept, but it's one of those ideas that's sort of hovering there in the zeitgeist.
Right,
I mean, it's like
right.
these, you know, horror amusement parks have become such a thing now, especially here in Southern California.
Yeah.
That
they become more of an event. I mean,
yes.
Like the premise here is it's almost like this is like a EDM style kind of thing where
it could be.
It's like this big, you know, youth oriented event where things are kind of ratcheted up a little bit. It's not a kid's haunted
yeah,
house.
Yeah, this year is my son. He's 13, and we're going to Universal.
Yeah.
And Six Flags, because Six Flags has a Hellfest maze. We've done the hayride for a few years, but this is his first year going to one, so he's amped
yeah.
for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's become a very big thing, and like, you know, every night somebody somewhere in there is thinking like, oh my God, what if one of these guys is real? And that's kind of the thrill of it. So it's not like a super duper original idea, but for me, the big original in for it is that I've been trying to champion. A lot of time for the last 2 years with my own original work is a return to fun horror. I love the Blumhouse model, and the Blumhouse model has taken over and you know everything that James Wan is doing with The Conjuring. Like, I love these movies. But for me, when I was in high school, sneaking into R-rated movies or having sleepovers with my friends, it was all about like watching these horror movies as a group, and you laugh at them to keep from getting scared because you don't want your friends to think you're scared, or they're just, you know, they're campy and they're silly. And it's like laughing and screaming at the same time are so much fun.
Yeah.
Like all the later Friday movies and like, you know, definitely most of the Freddy movies, you know, there's a level of fun to them that they're fun to watch. And that's what I feel like. I'm not saying no one has done it in recent years, because there's definitely have been a few, but like, I personally really miss the fun horror film. And
yeah.
like from the second one I went in and pitched on this thing, it was like this, I want this to be fun. If they're going to a place where you're supposed to have fun, we need to make this like a party movie. Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
like there's going to be an arc through the night of like, you know, you could take this, if you took the story that the characters are doing, where you have one friend who's been away, who is, you know, sort of like introverted and doesn't like literally let herself go free, and it's, you know, it's Halloween, have fun tonight. Like, you could make this could be like a teen comedy movie where like they meet up with the boys and this girl's like, oh, I'm going to let myself be free tonight. And then, you know, crazy things start to happen and the hijinks are just so happens in this case, it's murder.
But bloody, like, horrific murder.
You know, it's yeah.
Hey, well, what's great about that is that you're talking about basically kind of what you and I grew up. I'm older than you. Let's just say it. But the
by a lot.
Yes, by quite a bit. No. I'm downright crypt keeper age at this point. But the '80s era of horror films, and I'm, I guess, maybe kicked off by Halloween, because to me that seems like ground
yes.
zero for a lot of these
100%.
In terms of the way the genre kind of changed. Then it became like the Scream movies were, you know, meta because they're self-aware, mm-hmm. you know, and they were not, and then parodies of those kind of things. So what you're going back to is that kind of 80s style. It's funny that you say that, because to just today as we record this, there's been this big buzz online about an 80s style trailer
for
Hellfest,
which is so much fun.
Which the company actually did themselves,
yes.
right?
And I'm going to start petitioning them tonight about releasing an alternate cut of the movie entirely that style.
Shot that way.
Yeah.
I would actually like to see it actually squashed down for TV,
like a 4:3,
like with
yeah.
borders and have
tracking errors
and bad dubbing.
Oh my God,
for
so good.
Just the TV version of
I
it.
I would love that.
But yeah, look for the watch the Hellfest trailer and then watch the Hellfest 80s style trailer, even with a great Lionsgate old school logo at the beginning. It's fantastic.
Yeah. But no, but you're right. We've come full circle. We had the thing became camp, then the thing became postmodern with Scream, where we're going to be like meta about it, and then came the wave of parodies, and then, you know, now we're circling back to like
going and then,
back
and then to the dark period, like you're talking about, where things got like really, really saw. And,
well, but that's the appropriate reaction to follow the parody era.
Sure,
it's like no, we're going to double down on horror and, make it dark.
Yeah,
and yeah, I guess I'm kind of circling back around. I mean, it's horror is just the genre that will not ever die. If I see another think piece on like horror's here to stay, like it's horror's been strong consecutively nonstop for 100 years.
It's never and it still surprises people when these kind of random titles come up. The Nun comes out and it gets terrible reviews for the most part if you look at things like Rotten Tomatoes, and makes a crap load of money.
Yeah.
I mean, there is always an appetite for being scared, particularly in a movie theater. It is one of the genres left, one of the few genres left in the modern day, you know, walk in, pay you for a ticket cinemas outside of giant tentpole movies that you see in 3D. It is one of the few genres left that people want to go see in theaters because of that community of the group scare.
Yes.
The you know, it's there's something still really special about seeing it with a group of people and all kind of having the same experience.
And it's mostly profitable because it tends to be made on the cheap.
Right.
Not always on the cheap. I mean, even like It, for example, or you know, A Quiet Place. Like, these movies are huge.
Those are big studio releases with a lot more resources behind them, sure.
Sure. But even for a studio, they're on the lower budget side because they're made. I mean, horror works when it feels more stripped down and grounded, because then that's scarier when the weird shit starts to happen.
Right.
People like to be scared.
Does it help or hurt when a movie like Get Out, which is not, I mean, he's clearly a horror fan, and that was, you know, his template for starting that, or A Quiet Place comes out and kind of gets this other level of critical acclaim. That helps the genre, right? Or is there an expectation for things to be of a certain quality from at that point? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, well, Get Out is, first of all, edited by Greg Plotkin, who directed Hellfest.
Terrific.
That was still a relatively small movie. That was a Blumhouse, and Blumhouse works very lean, very tight. Quiet Place was, you know, bigger. That was a cheap acquisition because it was a script that existed that John Krasinski then went and, you know, overhauled and made into a thing. But you're going to, again, there's this division in fandom. There's going to be horror fans who are going to be like, Get Out's not a horror movie. It's more of a psychological thriller. And like, to them, a horror movie has to be an R-rated gore fest with naked women and somebody with a machete.
Yeah.
I use this as an example a lot, but my partner, Emily, she says she doesn't like horror movies.
Right.
And I'll say to her, what about Silence of the Lambs? She's like, oh, well, that's a thriller. What about Psycho? Oh, well, that's a classic. What about The Shining? Well, that's Kubrick. Like, there is a tendency for people to judge and define horror based purely upon 80s slasher films.
Yeah.
Where every, you know, somebody saw
kind of the extreme level of the visual or the gore or the whatever.
Right. They saw, like, on, you know, on cable, like on USA at midnight when they were 15 years old in the 80s or the 90s, like some B-level slasher film, and it was gross and terribly made and probably awful. It was probably like, you know, My Bloody Valentine or something like that. And from there, that's what they associate with horror movies. And, you know, and there are people who just don't like to be scared, and like, they don't get why anybody would want to be scared or, you know, celebrate violence or scary things. For most people,
I have to admit, I've never been a big fan of the genre. I will go to the ones that I hear are really good.
Yeah.
And it is torture for me. I hate the torture ones, by the way.
Yeah, no, they're not fun.
But movies that genuinely have a scare. I am the classic kind of avert my eyes from the screen. I am this close to just looking through fingers. I don't know why or how that could possibly help me.
Totally natural reaction. I don't think there's anything wrong with it at all.
Yeah, but it's not my favorite sensation. But I will go see the ones that I hear are just really good.
Do you
good.
Like roller coasters?
No.
See? I mean,
no.
But a lot of people do.
Yeah, I know that.
It's the exact same thing. It's like that.
No, it's
idea.
Not that I don't understand it, but yeah. I'm very self-aware. It's like, I know. I for instance, if you were, I know people who are like, you know what? I'm gonna jump out of a plane with a parachute once, just once. I want to experience that.
Well,
I'm like,
crazy.
Nope, I ain't gonna do that.
I'm not gonna do that.
No,
yet.
I have absolutely no. I mean, I literally know that there is nothing about me that is going to get anything out of that.
Yeah.
I appreciate life the way it is right now. I take my chances walking across Wilshire every day.
I mean, that's scary.
I almost get somebody making a right turn directly into me when I got the walk sign. Anyway,
it happens here too. It happened at our old location constantly as well.
Absolutely. No, I put my life in my hands. All the time. The most I will ever feel like a daredevil is when I have milk a day or so after the expiration date. I think I'm really flying in the face of danger. Let's continue to talk about Hellfest. So it came to you. Mm-hmm. You developed it. You basically took the concept and kind of, you know,
There were a few drafts before me, mm-hmm. that. And it's not to say they were bad. It was just not what the studio wanted. Movies are made today. They're never because they're good or bad. It's always like a checklist. We need to shoot here. We have this actor. We have this director. And a lot of times a script just doesn't fit what the studio needs to do, whether it's their money situation or whether it's the scope of what they want to show people. And a lot of times when, you know, the script doesn't work, a lot of times they'll stick with the writer. But most times, unfortunately, they just shift to another one. You can't write in this town and not end up being rewritten at least once and not rewrite somebody else at least once.
Yeah,
so,
and have it completely out of your control. That is totally. the plight of the writer for
yes.
years and years
Hellfest
and years.
Hellfest has about 300 writers credited to it. And basically,
not literally. I know there's a lot.
There's two entities. There's a team and another guy who share the story by credit. Those are the drafts that came before me. And from there, we used certain elements. We used certain ideas. They were good scripts, but for whatever reason, it's not what the studio wanted. I came in with a different, fresh, new, you know, version of it. And I set out with, you know, new characters. And that was a vision that I had. And that's what they said, great, let's do it. That's what we wrote. That's what got it greenlit. That's what they decided to prep and shoot. And then after me, there were two more writers. First, Kayla Cooper came on because they're like, you know, we feel like since it stars female leads, we should really have a quick polish from a female writer. And I'm like, absolutely, go for it. I have no problem with that. It's fine. And she's a great writer. And then, she moved up. She, you know, did something awesome like selling her own show to Netflix, getting staffed on Luke Cage. So she,
okay.
So then Blair Butler, who's another amazing writer, came on to sort of pick up where she left off, and Blair added, you know, some of her spin to the characters. And I could say it's awesome because ultimately the basic story structure and movement of it is still what I did, and all the main scares and the big beats are still mine, and they just, you know, made me look even better.
Great.
And I love
it. It's nice when that happens.
It has,
when
I mean,
you actually
they,
are happy yeah. with the work that's been done on something
you did.
The
guys before me might hate me. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know,
They probably do.
Yeah.
Hey, Hollywood boys, it's the way it happens, you know?
They're all working and they're all doing just fine.
And the check cleared.
Yes.
I would assume.
So basically, I had a few concepts that they liked from the previous versions, but for the most part, I came in and just sort of started at, started fresh.
And did you bring anything to the table where you were thinking, oh, here's an opportunity to go a direction I've been thinking about and I just didn't have a chance to do that? Or did you feel like you were working with not a blank slate entirely because you had the premise and you had kind of, you know, whatever you were given, the tools to work with, but did it open up an avenue for you to go, oh, I've always wanted to go this direction because, yeah.
And that's what the villain, with the actual,
oh, yeah.
with the other, the slasher, and that was mostly, I mean, obviously worked on after me, but like that was my big introduction to it, and I'm like, here, because that was really where they were sort of struggling, because in this sort of like post Scream world, like when, you know, the audience knows, like, how do you go back to basics without like being, you know, trite or arch about it? And what we, you know, had to come up with was like the thing that they were getting hung up on the drafts before me. It was like, what's the motivation of this killer? Why are they doing this? In one draft, it was, you know, poor Jimmy, the ride operator who got mangled and like, you know, his insurance claim was denied. Not really. But it was things like that. Like, there was a definite like search of like trying to find a good motivation for what this person would be.
Right. And does it need that?
Does it need that?
Yeah. Is that, I mean,
and that was basically
what you're
my
asking.
Approach.
Yeah.
Was like, my approach to this was like, no, what if we know nothing about it? Mm-hmm. And I'm not spoiling anything here because it happens in the first act of the film. But the guy comes into the park. You don't see him, but he comes into the park just like anybody else. Mm-hmm. But he smuggles in a mask. He finds a weapon. He pulls a hood up. And like, you know, this is a person who likes going to these places, and he just comes in. He goes in like he's just any one of us. He could be any other guy. That's just why would we call him the other?
Yeah.
But it just so happens this is the one night a year where he, you know, lets his crazy out, which is ironically now what all the kids and the stars of the whose story it is, like they're telling the lead, like, oh my God, let go, like just have fun for one night, be yourself, stop being so responsible, like let loose a little bit. And, you know, that message, you know, is taken to the extreme by the other.
Well, it's funny you say that, because one of the great things about some of the early movies we were talking about, whether it's like the original Halloween, the original mm-hmm. Friday the 13th, I mean, there is some backstory given, but it is a thumbnail.
It's a line. It's like he was born evil.
Yeah. And as the series collectively move along, they dig further into that. And the ironic thing, of course, is that one of the things that you got some crap about with Leatherface is that you were essentially creating an origin story.
Yeah.
And there are people who just didn't want that.
No.
I just want my villain to be an evil motherfucker touched by the devil in some way. Please don't give it an explanation. And that pisses people off. That's weird. Yeah. So it was, I mean, I like that the idea that maybe that's part of what this kind of style is going to be, which is we don't need to necessarily know everything about this guy.
Not everything. I mean, you get
until
I mean,
Hellfest 5.
It's all planned. It's all figured out.
You've got the full arc.
I mean, I hope so. Cause I'd like to just keep, you know, churning these out and getting paid for the rest of my life on them.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen the final cut, but I saw the almost final cut.
Does it satisfy the horror fan? Do you have any ability to pull yourself out of it and just enjoy it as a
Not
movie?
Not really, but I tried. you know, I mean, like what I saw, like because I had gone to work on a television show, so I was sort of out of the loop on the last, you know, on the when they were shooting it.
So you had some distance.
I had a little bit of distance, and you know, and like, you know, you can have things on a page, but when they get there on set, they, you know, things get tweaked. And Greg, to his credit, did this amazing thing to where, like, you know, we had the big beats, the big scares and the kills were in the script, but all the smaller things, like, you know, because they're at a theme park, it's you know, I saw this comment on one of the horror websites about after the trailer where somebody was like, it looks like a movie full of jump scares. I'm like, obviously you can't go to a horror theme park and be killed for real. The entire premise of a horror theme park is it's going to be nonstop jump scares. So Greg and had this great idea that, like, when they were blocking scenes, he would walk the actors through and say, okay, then, you know, Jimmy the monster is going to pop out right here and scare you. Act scared. They do one through, you know, do the walkthrough, do it a couple times, get it down right, do a take, do another take, do a third take. Then on the fourth take, he had a scare actor that the actors didn't know about jump out from somewhere else, and he'd get a real scare out of them. And, you know, and rattled their cages. So a lot of the times, a lot of the reactions you're seeing for them are legit.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And that, like, really captures
genuinely,
the spirit
like
of it.
It would be in that sort of
exactly.
real life scenario.
So when I watched it for the first time, a lot of those beats were like organic. Like the story was what I expected it to be, but and also the chemistry of the cast is amazing. The kids did an awesome job. They're so good. And that was like, you know, I could write words on a page forever, but, like, you know, having them find their, like, rhythm and their dynamics and their chemistry with each other, and then, you know, their little improvs, their little character beats as they start to inhabit the characters, it, you know, takes on a life of its own. You know, and that was like a treat to see for the first time as well.
How are you adjusting to being in the industry now? When we talked prior to Leatherface, you were still kind of almost getting your feet wet. I mean, Leatherface was really
the first
major project that was credited to you. You had just come off of an uncredited writing session that was a hilarious adventure for you in London, which I think
it's what people are aware of now. Now it was London Has Fallen. It's known. I'm credited.
We didn't talk much about it then, I think, because
I'm credited as an uncredited writer on IMDb.
Okay. So. London Has Fallen. But so now you've kind of had those. You've had the experience of some heavy criticism for something. Mm-hmm. You've had the experience of a really odd project that maybe you shouldn't have been a part of. But
I would never take London Has Fallen back. I mean, will I tell people go see this? It's a great movie. Yeah. Probably not, but it's super fun. If you like B action movies with great one-liners, obviously it's a fun movie. But like,
but as an educational experience from like the industry, I've seen something that you had never been through before and going, what is going on?
I mean, they're like, here's a bunch of money to go live in London for a month, have a per diem, live in a hotel, have an office at Pinewood next door to Star Wars, write one-liners for Gerard Butler, and write a fancy speech for Morgan Freeman, and get in the union. Yeah. Like, that's all win. There's nothing wrong with any of that. It was great.
So now you've got a little more experience under your belt. You've kind of navigated the industry a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You're establishing yourself in film and television, which we'll talk about the Hulu series, if we may.
Yes, sure.
How's it feeling? Do you feel at home?
I did Leatherface and London Has Fallen in the middle of Leatherface, and then I had a year with nothing.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it really, really, really is winning a lottery and breaking its odds to going against the odds to have a movie made and get paid for it and have it be a thing that happens. For it to happen a second time is even harder. And like, I was realizing that, like, I'm like, I made it, but like, you didn't really make it. Like, there's a lot of movie versions of one hit wonders behind the cameras. There's people who write movies and then don't ever write movies again.
Yeah, I'm very friendly with a number of people now who regularly work in the industry, and I see them. I mean, it is still a hustle from project to project. And I mentioned, I don't mean to keep name dropping, but Paul Feig. You know, I literally talked to him the last day before he went off to London, because he has not had back-to-back jobs ever. He's never had a time where he didn't have a big gap between movies.
Yeah.
And that's a guy who's had a couple of big successes, and you still have to really hustle. And sometimes you have to say yes to something because you really are afraid they're just going to go away.
I mean, I did, and those movies won't get made because, you know, for whatever reason.
Right.
That's fine.
Not because they're not brilliant scripts.
One of them got made, and I don't talk about it, and it's out there. People can find it, and it was a lesson in, like, you know, you can have something on a page that is good, but if you don't give it any money and you don't give it a qualified director and you don't give it people who can act and you still try to make it with those pieces, it may not be great.
Yeah.
Still learning experience. But I had a chunk or a time where I didn't work. And, you know, by the end of that year, I was like, well, okay, I guess I'm going back to the old career and going back to my previous job. And then I got a little thing that sort of floated me for a little while. And then I got another little thing. And then it started to, you know, then it started to pick up. I'm trying to track in my head where exactly it picked up. honestly, it was the lead up to Hellfest. I mean, there's a movie in there that, like, I mean, I've written a couple movies for places that went, like, out of business, because that happens with production companies.
Sure.
And they were just, you know, they were little things that floated me here and there. There were a couple, like, EP jobs on movies where basically I was a producer, which meant that they wanted me to write it, but they didn't want to pay union fees. So I sort of, you know, helped them shepherd the story. And, you know, I did lots of little things like that to sort of help me, you know, keep working. And then I had written a couple pilots, and they were read over at Valhalla, which is Galen Hurd's company. And they liked it, and I developed a TV show with them. I spent like half a year developing this TV show with them that we went out with, and ultimately Universal bought it, but we couldn't find a home for it, like, network-wise. But in that process of working with them, by the time we were done, I'm like, you know, I sent Gail this email where I'm like, I just, you know, thank you. I mean, we didn't find a home for the show, but I'm failing at like a really good level to have gone out with you to pitch a TV show to like all the major players.
Right.
And now, like, you know, everybody at like Netflix or Amazon or, you know, Universal, they're all like saying, hey, come back when you got another thing. Like, that's a really good place to be, even though we didn't land my thing. And, you know, to which Gail's response was like, well, I got this thing over here on a shelf that we haven't quite cracked called Hellfest. So it's coming out now, but for me, this was like, you know,
sure,
a couple years ago at this point.
That's one of the things when I talk to people in TV, producers, showrunners, head writers, that sort of thing, they get the opportunity to pitch. If they've been on anything good at all or have a certain
90% of my job.
Yeah, I mean, pitching, and in fact, one of my friends, Trey Calloway, is an executive producer and teaches a class in pitching at USC, which I think is brilliant. And because it is an art unto itself, it is nothing like what you do as a writer on a day-to-day basis.
No, it's what I do, spend most of my time doing, and you don't get paid for it.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking. Exhausting.
The process,
you just need to get one, though, and then, you're good for another couple years.
But it's when, to me, the thing, and I think maybe one of the things that I've always known, and one of the reasons I never really had maybe the guts to stay with this process when I was learning this, was to create something and pour your heart and soul into it and to put it out there and to get some traction and to get to a certain point. And then when it's killed, it goes away.
Yep.
And you don't, I mean, with very few exceptions, you don't get to bring that back.
No.
You don't get to revive that. That's not a thing you can turn around, especially when it's been shopped around to every major studio in town. It's like, you can't go back around for, round two and go, remember when you passed? You want to look at it again? You just have to move on. And that, to me, just, that kills me. That's like,
Like I said, that's why I say things like I'm failing at a really good level.
Yeah.
I just went out with a show with Amblin, and the two original TV shows I've gone out with, I'm with Gail Ann Hurd and with Steven Spielberg. I'm doing something right, even if they're not happening.
Yep.
That's what gets me through not crying myself to sleep at night.
You want to talk about the Hulu show?
Sure.
Light as a feather.
Stiff as a board.
which is a game I don't remember, but I brought that up to other people and they were like, of course.
Yeah.
So I was a sheltered and
lonely child. It may have been
child.
More of like a girl slumber party thing
instead
of a dude thing, especially in the 80s or 90s.
Yeah. This is, you want to describe the series a little bit? It is that concept.
It is a group of girls who play light as a feather, stiff as a board, and a cemetery on Halloween night.
Mm-hmm. That's not a good idea. Why are the kids still doing that?
The second I go online and
I don't mean your idea is not a good idea. It's in the universe of the place where the girls are living. You don't do that. Haven't you seen enough scary movies not to do that?
There's variations on this game. Regionally, it's like one of those things that changes depending on where you grew up.
Right.
So I went onto YouTube and watched people's just slumber party recordings of them playing this game for reference. And in the comments, it's YouTube comments, so take it with a grain of
a giant bag of salt.
A giant bag of salt from a home for people with an IQ of 2. and people are every one of them had a comment of like, oh, well, you just invited a demon into your house.
Oh, boy.
Like, fully believing it. So one regional version of this is when you do the light as a feather, stiff as a board, is that you tell, before you do the levitation, you tell the story of how the person who's going to levitate is going to die. It's like whoever's running the game makes up a story and says, oh, my God, they were on their way to soccer practice and got hit by a bus. Whatever it is, they tell this gruesome story and then you float. So with our girls in this story, they do that, and then the girls actually start to die in the fashion the game was predicted.
And this is how many episode series?
10 half-hour episodes.
Is it an anthology series? Or
nope.
If so, there is an arc that it could – or is it a limited series?
If it could people continue. Like it, it could definitely continue. It ends on a nice – it's got some good cliffhangers toward the end.
When is this all
2 weeks.
Episodes available?
October 12th.
Well, don't say 2 weeks on a podcast.
October 12th. 2 weeks after Hellfest comes out.
Perfect.
Very.
Why Hellfest a month before October? Was that just open on the schedule?
Well, you don't want to compete with Michael Myers.
Oh, crap. That guy.
That guy.
That guy again. And Jamie Lee again.
It's a window. We're at the 28th. We're at the beginning of the Halloween season. It'll carry through.
It doesn't matter. It's going to do fine.
I like to think there's a different audience for Hellfest. I mean, I'm amped for Halloween, but I don't know how many 17-year-olds really give a shit about Michael Myers. I hope they do. I'm friends with a lot of people who worked on that movie, and I want it to do well, and I'm excited for it.
Yeah, there's some nostalgic, there's some nostalgia energy behind that, but not necessarily. Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
I feel like we're definitely targeting a younger audience than they are.
Totally.
So,
I'm very excited. Hellfest. By the time you hear this, it will be it's probably going to be available tonight. Let's say
September 28th,
And available right now. Quick questions, lightning round, whatever you want to call it. I can't remember if I asked you last time what your favorite horror movie of all time. Can you remind me?
No, because I'm sure every time I ask, I give a different answer.
It's a different answer. What would it be right now?
Today, it's The Shining.
Okay. What is your favorite movie all time, period, all genre?
Blade Runner.
Oh, cool. If you were forced to go up on a karaoke stage at gunpoint, what is the go-to song?
Shout at the Devil, Motley Crue.
Very nice. Do they usually have that available at karaoke nights?
At the karaoke places I've gone to infrequently, yes.
Excellent. of all the accoutrement, decoration, or possessions within your home that you do put out at Halloween, what is your most prized?
Ooh. I mean, the 12-foot tall inflatable light-up ghost is pretty good.
That's pretty sweet.
I mean, it's just a Home Depot buy, but...
Do you have any collectibles? Do you collect stuff?
I don't have a lot of horror collectibles. Yeah. I have some. I do have a lightsaber collection. That mine are legit though. Like I one of the things I need in my life is a physical hobby because like so much of my work is in my head.
Yeah, something to do with your hands.
A lot of times I need something to do with my hands.
Right.
And for a while was one day like 3-4 years ago, I was looking at one of my son's Nerf guns, and I'm like, that thing's really cool looking. Like that would be someone could use that in a sci-fi movie if it didn't look like it was a plastic toy.
Right.
So I grabbed it and I painted it and I made it look like some sort of movie sci-fi weapon. I'm like, that was super fun. So I went and bought like thousands of dollars worth of Nerf guns and was doing that for a while. And one day going through a box, I found this thing called a Graflex three-cell camera flash. And I had this thing because I was in this unique position in the mid-90s of being a Star Wars fan when Star Wars was not popular, and also being a photo major in undergrad. And I just so happened to know, like, read somewhere that, like, the original lightsaber props from the 70s were built out of these old press camera flashes, like the big... if you ever seen the Public Eye with Joe Pesci, right on the cover of the movie poster, he's holding the giant old press camera with the big dish with the light bulb in it.
Yeah.
I'm making hand gestures, but I realize this is an audio medium. that camera flash is what they use to make some of the lightsaber props.
Okay.
There's a few different models of it. And I knew this, and I like, you know, I got it, and I you know, did my best to make it look like a lightsaber when I was in my 20s, and I was very proud that like I was one of the few people who knew this and figured it out. After I was painting my son's Nerf gun, I found this thing. And I'm like, I want to do this right now because there's now that we have the internet and HD versions of Star Wars, I'm sure I can do a much better recreation. And I come to find out that there's an entire community of Star Wars prop enthusiasts who track down because like the original Star Wars movie was technically pretty low budget.
Yeah.
Like George Lucas was flying by the seat of his pants.
Yeah, they were slapping stuff together or taking model kits and, throwing it on. Yeah,
exactly. And like for everything in the desert on Tatooine, all the production design, they literally went and spent a sterling pound for a physical pound of airline and military scrap from a junkyard. And from that, they built all these crazy metallic things.
Just pieced it together.
And so like there's this entire community of guys who have like studied pictures and like found like, oh, that knob is from a British turntable that was made in, I'm not even joking, that was made in the 70s.
Yeah,
and they track it down and they buy it. And it's become this whole thing. And there's guys who like take these things and 3D scan them and make replica parts. So I was able to like, I'm like, you know what? I can do this right now because now I can buy like the grips on this lightsaber are like cabinet runner, like door cabinet runner from the 70s in England. Not very easy to find now, but there's people who make faithful, like, one-to-one recreations of it that you can buy and stick on your lightsaber prop. So I know Lucasfilm puts out, like, official lightsaber prop replicas, but I've tracked down the actual camera parts and have remade these things and built them with my own hands. And that is the nerdiest thing, actually, second nerdiest thing about me.
What's the first?
The first nerdiest thing is, like, if you took all the hate mail I got from Leatherface, combine it with the happy mail that I got from Leatherface, and combined that with the mail I've started to get with Hellfest, it's still only a fraction of the feedback and responses I got from a self-published online e-book that I made breaking down exactly all this information about Star Wars lightsaber props. It's an 80-page book that I designed and made myself. And
you can't count that as first nerdiest. Both of those are combined under one giant nerdy headline. Oh,
you know,
good
I do
Lord.
All these interviews to talk about horror stuff, and I always end up talking about Star Wars.
I don't know. Somehow it all comes back to Star Wars, doesn't it? It just does. Final question, contractually obligated to ask this. It's not me. It's my overlords.
Sure.
Have you, since we last talked, had an encounter with, worked with, or in any way dealt with a monkey?
A monkey? No.
Well,
does that mean they're going to make you change the name?
No.
Is that the problem?
No, it's just, it just makes for a really crappy ending to a podcast. No. No monkey.
I mean, I saw one of the Planet of the Apes movies and had, you know, some feelings about it. Does that count?
That does count.
Okay.
And we won't go into that because then there's another 2 hours of discussion. Which one? Oh, never mind.
The last one.
Okay.
The last one.
That was pretty good.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
It was all right.
I mean, okay. We don't have to get into it.
Seth, good luck and congratulations.
Thank you,
I have a feeling the movie is, what's it competing against? There's nothing even remotely close genre-wise.
Hence the other reason why it comes out.
Yes, they found the right spot.
September 28th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we won't plug the other ones. Fuck them. All right. Seth, proud of you.
Thank you, sir.
Excited for you.
Thank you.
I wish you great success, but not so much that you will stop talking to me.
Well, I mean, if Paul Feig can still come around, I mean, I'm sure I can slum it.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Wait a minute. Okay, the end.
Get a monkey. Get a monkey!
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.